Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
In 1867, a young man from a famous American family wanted to make a splash as a historian. His name was Henry Brooks Adams, and in the 1800s, the Adams family was kind of a big deal. His father, Charles Adams, had been President Lincoln's ambassador to London. His grandfather had been no less than John Quincy Adams, the 6th President of the United States. So, needless to say, he came from some rather impressive stock. But Henry's destiny was not to be in politics. Instead, he was determined to make his name as an academic. And to that end, he went looking for a sacred cow he could topple over in the name of good history. Perhaps unsurprisingly, he set his eyes on the history of the American South. The Civil War had only been over for a few years, and tensions between the North and the South hadn't exactly cooled. Henry Adams was a Harvard-educated Boston native whose family had worked for the Lincoln administration. Suffice it to say, he was pretty loyal to the Union. Now, like many Northern academics, he had no qualms about rubbing salt in the wounds of the defeated South. Indeed, it's been mentioned by more than one observer that the unstated goal of many of the Boston historians of this era was to completely write the South out of America's history, starting with early colonial times. The very first English colonies that would become the United States had been in Virginia, and after the Civil War, well, that just wouldn't do. So, new histories were written that would emphasize the importance of the Mayflower, Plymouth Rock, and the Puritans of Massachusetts. It would be this northern city on the hill that would come to define the myth of American beginnings. However, the fact still remained that the Virginia colony predated its northern cousins. So Henry Adams made it his personal mission to knock the colony down a peg. And so, he zeroed in on one of Virginia's most cherished legends from the early colonial days, the romantic story of how the indigenous woman Pocahontas saved Captain John Smith from execution. The story had a strong whiff of mythology about it, and Adams sensed that it would not stand up to careful historical scrutiny. In other words, it would be a great way to both make a name for himself as a historian and stick it to the South. And Adams made no bones about the intended effect of his examination of John Smith and Pocahontas. He apparently gloated, quote, "The Virginia aristocracy will be utterly graveled by it," end quote. Years later, he would also comment that, quote, "No other stone that could be thrown by a beginner would attract more attention and probably break as much glass," end quote. You see, Henry Adams knew something that fans of this podcast know all too well. Busting historical myths is very sexy. But Henry Adams was hardly on an impartial quest for the truth. He wore his biases boldly on his sleeve. He wanted these Southern heroes to be brought low. And that should perhaps give us at least a moment of pause. Can myth-busting itself be a tool to help give rise to new myths? Indeed, the story of Pocahontas has been one of the most enduring tales from the early colonial era. It's been held up as one of the most important creation stories for the United States. It's been romantically cast as the moment when indigenous people and white settlers came together to form a new and better country. The layers of meaning that have been imposed on this little historical anecdote are hard to see past when trying to determine if it actually happened. When Henry Adams set out to bust the Pocahontas myth, was he actually bringing his readers closer to the truth, or was he just trying to ruffle the feathers of his political enemies? Perhaps there could be more truth to the Pocahontas story than men like Adams would have us believe. Was John Smith just an arrogant braggart who tried to spice up his own autobiography? Or was there something more complicated going on that fateful day when Pocahontas threw herself on Smith's body? All that and more on today's Our Fake History. Episode number 35. Did Pocahontas really save John Smith? Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major and this is the show where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. Today we are taking on a story that is so fairy tale-like that it was even adapted by Disney. I speak, of course, about Pocahontas, perhaps history's most well-known indigenous woman. In fact, there are so few indigenous women whose names have become part of the mainstream historical consciousness that the name Pocahontas has become synonymous with the trope of the, quote, Indian princess. I mean, try and test yourself right now. How many indigenous North American women can you name from history? Beyond Pocahontas and Sacagawea, unless you've studied indigenous history closely, the list probably ends there. And that's because, traditionally, indigenous women haven't really been served all that well by mainstream history. Their stories are perhaps among the most ignored and least taught when constructing the grand narrative of North America. The great exception of this is, of course, Pocahontas. She is an elemental part of America's creation story. The story of her bravely saving John Smith from the hands of her father's executioners contains everything that a good colonial creation myth needs. The beautiful but wild woman stands in as an easy metaphor for the country itself. She falls in love with the adventuring colonial, despite the fact that her people see him as dangerous. She saves him and in doing so, welcomes him to the country. The continent has now accepted the newcomers and the colonial project is given the blessing of the first people. Or so goes one particularly colonial interpretation of the event. The story of Pocahontas is so romantic that it's far easier to believe that this story is just a charming little myth than an actual historical event. Indeed, when Henry Adams set out to disprove it, he was kind of going after some low-hanging fruit. Or so he thought. And yet, there's something about the Pocahontas story that keeps bringing historians back to it. Many have argued that perhaps it should not be dismissed so readily. After all, Pocahontas was a real person who lived a remarkable life, not just some literary invention. But getting a true sense of her from the sources can be kind of tricky. Most of what we know about her comes from the writings of John Smith himself, and he tells us surprisingly little about her. His writings, paired with the observations of other early colonists who knew her, are all we really have to patch together a picture of who she was. As a result, she remains a bit of a mystery. It also means that this whole story is going to take two podcasts to properly tell. In this first part, we need to set the table a little bit. We need to figure out what was going on in Virginia in the early 1600s, what the English were doing there, and who this John Smith character was anyway. We also need to take a close look at Pocahontas and her people and try and understand what it meant when these two worlds came together. Then, in part two, I want to dive deep into the theories that have developed about this story and try to decide if we can believe any of it. All right, before we can do any of that, let's go back to 1607 and the shores of Virginia. Thank you. 1607, England was just starting to dip her toes into the world of colonization. Now, it can be easy for us to think that England was always a dominant player when it came to snatching up colonies around the globe. This is perhaps because the British Empire would eventually be that sprawling thing that, proverbially, the sun never set on. Indeed, by the 1800s, England would cement itself as the most powerful colonial power in the world. In that period, nearly a third of the planet was somehow being administered by the British Empire. But in the early 1600s, those days were still far off. England had actually been a bit of a latecomer to the colonial project, and were in many ways a middling power compared to Spain, France, and Portugal. As we've explored in previous shows, these countries had been in the business of exploration and exploitation for well over 100 years by the 1600s. The Spanish had easily been the most successful up to that point. The brutal campaigns of the conquistadors had claimed for Spain massive amounts of territory in the Americas. This is not to mention the huge amounts of silver and gold that came along with those recently conquered territories. By the late 1500s, Spain was running a global empire funded by massive resource extraction. Meanwhile, the English mostly just contented themselves with being pirates. Their early forays into empire building were basically just smash and grab missions. The crown legitimized pirates through letters of marque, making them now privateers. Basically, these guys would raid Spanish ships with impunity, tried to steal as much gold as they could, and they were given the official stamp of approval by the English government as long as the crown got a cut. But by the early 1600s, it had become clear that an empire could not be built on piracy alone. To be a truly competitive great power in this era, you needed real colonies. The North American mainland was already being gobbled up by England's imperial rivals. The French had claimed the mouth of the St. Lawrence River and what would eventually become Canada. The Spanish had also established a foothold in Florida. It had become clear to the English that if they didn't establish some sort of presence in the New World, they could basically kiss any long-term imperial ambitions goodbye. So in 1584, Queen Elizabeth gave a royal charter to one of her court favorites, the lovable rogue Sir Walter Raleigh. He was to go forth and colonize, quote, remote, heathen, and barbarous lands, countries, and territories, not actually possessed of any Christian prince or inhabited by Christian people, end quote. Now, Walter Raleigh fits the mold of a really interesting character type in this period that I like to call the Elizabethan bad boy adventurer. These were gentlemen with a reputation for both heroism, genius, and loose morals. They were patriots whose exploits always served the empire, but they were also hard-partying scoundrels. Guys like Raleigh and the infamous privateer Sir Francis Drake are probably the most well-known of these bad boys. They were kind of like the James Bond of the era. Stylish, dangerous, and they always got the girl. What's interesting for our story is that Captain John Smith also fancied himself to be one of these international men of mystery. Indeed, his autobiographical writings feel like someone who's trying to prove that they're just as cool as Sir Walter Raleigh or Sir Francis Drake. Now, despite Walter Raleigh's reputation for derring do, he was not particularly effective as a colonist. In 1584, he sent a small group to claim the Chesapeake Bay for England and form a colony on Roanoke Island. They were able to claim a new territory of Virginia for Queen Elizabeth. However, the fort was soon abandoned and many of the settlers decided instead to turn to piracy. In 1587, Raleigh tried again to settle the island and met with a little more success, but this settlement was also doomed. After the settlers ran out of provisions, the man Raleigh had sent to run the colony, a certain John White, returned to England in order to get much-needed supplies. What was supposed to be a 1-year journey would eventually become a 3-year ordeal. By the time white returned to the colony in 1590, the 90-some settlers had all disappeared without a trace. The only clue was the word Croatoan carved into a tree. Now, this may have meant that they had been attacked by the local indigenous group that went by that name, or that they'd all taken off for some nearby islands that also used that name. Either way, the settlers were gone, and they were never heard from again. Suffice it to say, the early attempts to colonize Virginia were straight-up disasters for the English. The English crown may have claimed large swaths of North America as its own, but by the turn of the 17th century, this was basically a fantasy. So in 1607, when John Smith and his company arrived at the mouth of the James River, they were pretty much starting the colonial project from scratch. This group of settlers had been sent by the Virginia Company, a joint stock venture that had been given a royal charter in 1606 by King James I. These companies were part independent business ventures and part extensions of the English crown. They had special permission to colonize and govern any land they could in the New World, so long as the king got a cut of the revenues. It's weird to think of, but basically England outsourced its colonial project to the free market. The entrepreneurs who made up the leadership of this expedition were hoping that they would either find tons of gold or potentially a passage to the Pacific Ocean. Unfortunately for them, they would find neither. But Plan B was essentially to set up shop, build a sturdy fort, and start planting cash crops. In April of 1607, the company selected an easily defensible peninsula roughly 40 kilometers up the James River. This would be the site of their new town, and they would name it Jamestown in honor of their king. The leader of this expedition was one Christopher Newport, but he had actually been instructed by the company to share the responsibilities of administration with at least six other men. This power-sharing arrangement was uneasy, to say the least. We're told that even before the ships landed in Virginia, there had already been some fierce power struggles among the captains. The result was that Newport had actually clapped one of the other captains in irons, imprisoned him in the brig, and threatened to execute him for mutiny. That possibly mutinous troublemaker who arrived in the New World in chains was none other than our old pal, Captain John Smith. Now, Smith is kind of a fascinating figure. Moreover, your feelings about him are basically going to shape how you understand this entire story. He's been portrayed as a brave everyman who is beloved by the common soldier and respected by the indigenous people of Virginia. However, he's also been portrayed as an arrogant, quick-tempered fool whose blundering led the colony into protracted periods of violence with the local Powhatan people. So, who was this guy? Well, John Smith wrote extensively about his life and travels, but the book that most comprehensively tells the tale of Smith is his 1630 memoir, The True Travels and Observations of Captain John Smith. Now, the veracity of Smith's autobiography is a matter of some debate, mostly because he loves spicing up his tales of adventure with anecdotes about ladies around the world falling madly in love with him. This is obviously something we should keep in mind when we start picking apart the Pocahontas story. Nevertheless, there are many facts about John Smith's life that are generally accepted by historians. Firstly, Smith came from humble origins. He was born the son of tenant farmers in the small English town of Willoughby in 1580. However, he was never particularly satisfied with the farmer's life, and at the age of 16, he left home and put to sea, trying to seek fame and fortune as a mercenary and a privateer. He fought against the Spanish during the Dutch Wars of Independence before heading to the Mediterranean to trade and engage in a little casual piracy. He eventually found his calling fighting the Turks in the Balkans with the army of the Austrian Habsburgs. Now, one of the most famous stories from this period in John Smith's life has to be the time that he took on three Turkish soldiers in single combat. Now, this is kind of an awesome story. We're told that during a long siege, a Turkish captain got fed up with waiting around and challenged Smith to a duel. Little did he know, the man he had just challenged was a master swordsman. We're told that Smith ran up to the Turk and with the very first swing of his sword, took his head right off of his shoulders. One of the Turkish captain's men, embarrassed with how quickly the whole thing had unfolded and wanting to avenge the death of his master, decided he would also challenge Smith to a duel. He had a bit more luck. The two grappled for a bit before they ended up pulling out pistols and shooting at each other. Smith was able to mortally wound the young Turkish man and eventually decided to behead him as well. Well, then a third Turk decided that he was going to try his hand with Smith, and the two whipped out battle axes and went at it with those. And what do you know? Smith cut his head off too. This so impressed the Prince of Transylvania, one Sigismund Bathory, that he knighted Smith and awarded him a coat of arms that prominently featured the image of three severed Turkish heads. It's actually quite something to look at. I'll post it on Facebook. Now, that's one of those stories that seems a little bit too wild to be true. And yet, the existence of this coat of arms seems to be a testament to its veracity. So, I'll let you decide on that one. Anyway, eventually Smith's luck on the battlefield ran out, and he was captured by his enemies and sold into slavery. Now, once again, we get a little anecdote from Smith about this that seems a little too romantic to be true. In his True Travels, Smith tells us that upon being made a slave, he is then bought by a wealthy Turkish lord and sent back to Constantinople to act as a household slave for the man's mistress, a beautiful Greek woman named Sheretaza. We're told by Smith that the woman, upon seeing him, immediately fell in love with him. Does that sound familiar? The dashing Smith was apparently irresistible, and Sheretaza desperately wanted to marry him. But she couldn't as long as he was a Christian. Worried that the Turkish lord might sell him again, Sheretaza sent Smith to live with her brother, an Ottoman administrator in the Black Sea region. She was hoping that her brother could teach Smith Turkish, get him to convert to Islam, and instruct him in the art of being a Turkish bureaucrat. This would basically transform him into suitable marriage material. The brother, though, had different plans for Smith, and instead, he subjected him to the most menial form of slavery imaginable. But Smith was not a man to be kept down for long, so we're told that one day, he just snaps and bashes his master's head in with his bare hands. He then disguises himself in the dead man's clothes, steals his horse, and rides hard until he eventually makes it back to Christian territory. If we can believe Smith, and some historians like Philip Barbour think that we can for the most part, then he lived the craziest life ever. And those are just the big moments. Along the way, there are shipwrecks, brilliant tricks that win him battles, and all sorts of piracy. By the time Smith arrived in Virginia, he had already gained a reputation as a pretty incredible dude. He fancied himself to be England's greatest adventurer since Sir Francis Drake. And he may have been right. Nevertheless, the aristocratic men of the Virginia Company saw him as an upjumped peasant with an ego that was not becoming of a man with such low class. It's unclear exactly what Smith did to get himself clapped in irons on the voyage over. But as soon as you know a little bit about Smith's biography, it becomes easy to see how he might have clashed with a disciplined-minded English nobleman. However, when the company arrived in Virginia, Smith was spared from the gallows. The orders from the Virginia Company were unsealed, and Smith was named as one of the key administrators of the new colony. Newport also knew that this small band of colonists couldn't afford to lose men, especially military men like Smith. And so Smith was let off with a stern warning. It turns out narrowly escaping execution would kind of become this guy's thing. But for now, a huge amount of work needed to be done if Jamestown was going to avoid the fate of the doomed Roanoke colony. And so, the colonists got down to it. When the English first arrived in Virginia, they perceived it as an unclaimed land, a place on the map where neither the French nor the Spanish had planted their flag. This could not have been further from the truth. The territory that the English called Virginia was actually smack dab in the middle of a powerful political entity united under a charismatic leader. This was the Powhatan Confederacy. The Powhatan Confederacy was a group of around 30 Algonquin-speaking tribes who had been united under the leadership of the great chief Wahunsunaka, or, as he's also known, Powhatan. Before the arrival of the English, Powhatan had carved out a small empire that wasn't all that different from the feudal states of Europe. Each tribe had a local lord or chief who had the ability to make decisions about his own territory, but he had to pay tribute to Powhatan as his overlord. This system both kept the peace internally and made the Confederacy a formidable match for anyone who wanted to threaten them externally. Unbeknownst to the English, they had just set down and started building a fort in the middle of one of the most powerful and organized indigenous states in eastern North America. By all accounts, Powhatan himself was a formidable person. At the time of the English arrival, he would have been around 60 years old, but we're told he'd lost none of his vigor. What's interesting is that even in the English accounts, which are notoriously cruel when it comes to indigenous people, the writers still can't help but express how impressive Powhatan was as a person. Most descriptions from this period describe any indigenous person as a savage or as barbarians or as being ugly, stupid, or devilish, whatever that means. But Powhatan is always described as being thoughtful, subtle, and deeply intimidating. For instance, John Smith described Powhatan as having, quote, such a grave and majestical countenance as drove me into admiration to see such a state in a naked savage, end quote. Now, it's interesting because in that quote, you can hear Smith questioning his own prejudices. I mean, he's still pretty condescending. He just can't believe that a First Nations person could actually be good-looking and carry himself like a king. Nevertheless, even with all of his prejudices, Smith still has to admit that Powhatan was a very impressive person. He would have had to have been to keep his some 30 tribes united. It's been estimated that nearly 20,000 people lived in the Powhatan Confederacy. Their nation was essentially a network of towns and villages made up of traditional longhouses. They were farmers who raised corn, squash, beans, and other crops. In many ways, Powhatan's Confederacy was not all that different from a small agricultural kingdom in Europe. But despite this, to Europeans of the period, Powhatan's sophisticated Confederacy just seemed like a rabble of savages. This underestimation would first get them into quite a lot of trouble, but then would also help them justify later atrocities. One of the things that would have scandalized the Europeans of that period was Powhatan's polygamy. Apparently, Powhatan took a wife from each of the different tribal groups under his control. All of those women each bore him one and only one child before being sent back to their home village. Once they were there, they were allowed to marry again. This system was essentially a way to promote unity among the 30 tribes. The idea was that the king would have a child from each of the tribes, and this would cement his status as the father of all of his people. Now, unfortunately, we know very little about Powhatan's children, except for one notable exception, Pocahontas. We're told that she was Powhatan's favorite child and had a reputation for being sprightly and energetic. The 17th century English sources like to say frolicsome. Pocahontas was just one of many names that she carried. It was the name that would have been used with strangers or in an official capacity, but in keeping with the tradition of her people, she also had a secret name that would have only been used by her family. This was Mataoka, which roughly translates to bright stream between the hills. Now, when we think of Pocahontas, we usually picture her as a young woman around the age of 18 or 19. This image was thoroughly hammered into our heads thanks to the Disney movie that came out in the 90s. Indeed, most pop culture depictions of Pocahontas put her at that age. Even Terrence Malick's film The New World, which is actually pretty historically accurate, chose to cast a woman in her early 20s as Pocahontas. With that in mind, you can perhaps understand my surprise when I learned exactly how young Pocahontas was when she first met John Smith. She was 14 at the oldest. In John Smith's first known description of her, he guesses that she was, quote, a child of 10. So before we go any further with this story, remember that the Pocahontas we're talking about is a kid. Now, there's a good argument to be made that she had to have been at least 12 around the time that she met Smith. The justification for this being that she would eventually serve as a type of ambassador for Powhatan, a role that would have only been entrusted to someone who had reached the age of maturity. In the Powhatan Confederacy, the age of maturity was 12. So it was unlikely that she was any younger than that. Nevertheless, the fact of Pocahontas's age kind of boggled me when I first came across it. So the first myth we need to bust is the idea that John Smith and Pocahontas were two young adults who were swimming in streams together, having a romantic courtship. John Smith was 27, and Pocahontas was probably a preteen. But aside from these basic facts, we know almost nothing about Pocahontas' life before she met Captain John Smith. What we do know is that their first encounter would end up changing her life forever. It would send her down a path that would lead to her emergence as a political actor, her change in religion, and eventually a new life in England. Amazingly, this young girl would become instrumental in making sure that the English survived in Virginia. If it were not for her, there would have been no Jamestown, there would have been no British North America, and then there would have been no United States. The Jamestown colony got off to a pretty rocky start. There was almost immediately conflict between the English and the various tribes who lived along the river. Right when the English got off the boat, they were attacked by a small band of local people, none too pleased to see Europeans on their shores. Apparently, these were not the first Europeans that they had come in contact with. Only a few weeks earlier, the tribes had apparently had an unpleasant experience with a Spanish ship. During the fight, we're told that one Captain Wingfield actually had an arrow pass clean through his beard. I'm not really sure how that works, but I just love the image of that. Anyway, the English were able to fend off the attack, and they started the process of building their fort. Now, despite this early aggression, it wasn't like all the tribes in the Confederacy simply wanted the English gone. It is true, many were openly hostile, but others thought that they should be allowed to stay so that they could benefit from trade with them, while other groups thought that if they just left them alone, their little colony would eventually die. After all, to the eyes of the Powhatan people, the English had picked a really bad spot to build their settlement. There was a reason that it wasn't occupied. The English had picked it basically because it seemed easily defensible, and there was a nice spot nearby where they could park the boats. But other than that, it was basically just a swampy wetland that was bad for growing crops and was a hotbed for disease. As a result, the Jamestown colony nearly failed before it ever got off the ground. Between the disease, the lack of food, and the intermittent attacks from unfriendly tribes, the English were in pretty rough shape. In the first few months of the colony, on average, someone died every day. By September of 1607, 60 of the original 104 settlers were dead. Jamestown was just a small, sickly little fort on a swamp whose days seemed numbered. It became clear to the surviving colonists that if they were going to make it, they were going to need the help from the Powhatans. Quite simply, they needed food, and the indigenous people seemed to have plenty of it. It was in these conditions, in December of 1607, that John Smith decided to head up the river. His mission was to hunt and explore the river, but he was also hoping to find Powhatan. The English relations with the local people had been patchy, to say the least. For every tribe willing to trade with them, there were two more that wanted to see them dead. Smith had heard that all the local tribes pledged allegiance to one great king. If Jamestown was going to survive, he needed to find that king and get him on the side of the colony. As it turned out, John Smith would not have to wait long before he had a chance to meet Powhatan face to face. He'd only been up the river for a few days when he was captured by Powhatan's brother while out hunting. He was then taken immediately to the capital of the Confederacy. He was brought before the chief, and what happened next? Well, that would become a thing of legend. Okay, that's all for this week. I know you're thinking, why are you cutting me off right there? You're just about to get to it. I know, I'm going to be cheeky like that and wait for 2 weeks before we actually get deep into the myth of Pocahontas. So please join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will hear the end of that story. In the meantime, if you would like to support the show, the number one best way to do it is to support us through Patreon. So for those of you that don't know what this is, Patreon is a system of monthly donations that you give to art that you like. You can go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and you can decide if you want to pledge at the $1, $3, $5 level or even more if you'd like. At each level, there's different rewards that you get. For instance, extra episodes and exclusive content that you can't get anywhere else. So if you're into that, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and check it out. As always, I need to give a big thank you to everyone who's been supporting the Patreon campaign so far, and everyone that's been giving one-off donations, and anyone who goes to ourfakehistory.com and buys the extra episodes. All of this stuff helps keep the podcast sustainable. The more successful all these things are, the more time I'm able to devote to the podcast and get more good stuff out there. I also need to give an especially big thanks to Jeremy Collins, PF, Morgan Bassett, Ole Wisco, and Heinrich Kvarfort. I really hope I got that right, Heinrich. All of you lovely people have decided to support the show at $5 or more a month on Patreon. And so, as always, I have to say, you guys rule. You are the people who clearly care about the show enough to want to give some of your hard-earned cash over to it. And that's generous and amazing, and you guys kick the butts. But if you're someone out there that doesn't really have any extra money to kick in, but you still really want to support the show, then the number one best way to do it is to go to iTunes and write a nice review of Our Fake History. The ratings and the reviews help us get seen by more people on iTunes, and hopefully more people listen to the show. So spread the love, please. If you want to get in touch with me, I am easy to find on the internet. You can go to ourfakehistory@gmail.com and you can write me a email there. You can follow along on Twitter at ourfakehistory, and I love hearing from people on Twitter. Or you can go to Facebook.com/ourfakehistory. You can become a fan of our Facebook page. I put up pictures, I give hints about future shows, and I talk to you guys there. So if you think you want to talk to me, those are all the places that you can find me. One last thing, the band that brings us our theme music, Dirty Church, they are going to be playing a show in Toronto, Ontario, Canada on February 15th at the Cameron House. So if you happen to be in Toronto on February 18th of 2017, then think about coming out and checking out Dirty Church. You can also check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. All the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.